in the beginning, when you were talking about some of the differences between deep ecologists and traditionalists.
And traditionalists and even the traditionalists split up, yeah.
I'm wondering if the conversation about, actually just read an article, I think it was on panpsychism, which is sort of come in. I'm wondering if the idea about consciousness is in what we, what sorts of consciousness we attribute to beings at various levels. The human beings have certainly very complex and higher level, or I don't want to use higher level, like complex level of consciousness. And, and a tree has consciousness potentially as well, and grass and down. I wonder if that plays into that conversation with the differences between different types of approaches by environmentalists and environmental ethics.
Okay, there are some deep ecologists that either would admit it, or you read them and you would think that they are what you were calling a panpsychist. So someone who thinks that consciousness floats onto more things than just human beings and maybe upper animals, trees, rocks, okay? Deep ecology is really a very large collection of a bunch of people who kind of share this kind of approach where we need a new approach and we need a deeper approach that doesn't simply decide on what to do next, but actually reverberates back and comes out of the way I think about things, okay? But there is a very large group where you have certain people that are deep ecologists that would, you know, look at you, that's just weird. And I have no problem if you want to think that, but I don't think we have to think that, versus others that would want to, that could be a possibility. Okay. I'm trying to think of.
Well, and I'm thinking about that relative to the intrinsic value and the instrumental value as well. If that's playing.
But there's a lot of people that think you can have intrinsic value without necessarily being conscious. Okay, it doesn't, I mean, so some of the views they talk about having a good, okay? So as long as there's some sort of a, you know, what Aristotle would call the purpose of process, a teleology, that this thing, this animal, this tree, even this ecosystem seems to be moving towards some sort of a goal, and even the goal could be just simply equilibrium. Okay, then a lot of people would say, well, that's enough to get you going on whether this thing has value, because it's got values. Okay, and it doesn't have to be, so this is where I'm coming back to you, they don't have to be consciously thinking about them to have a value. Okay, so survival, I mean, we look at a lot of animals and we see the things, well, they just want to survive, right? Well, it's not that they're sitting around, you know, how can I survive, right? But they're doing what they do, but the process seems to be ordered towards survival, or there's a lot of other more fuller things. And for, you know, a lot of people, that's enough. Okay? So Tom Reagan says that's enough to give animals a right, a moral right to things like life, some sort of freedom. Okay? So he doesn't think they have consciousness. A lot of students, my students, you know, you read that right away, you think, well, he's thinking that animals are conscious. I don't think animals are conscious in that way. And he's not thinking that he has to be actually pinned that way. That no, they just have to have and a tree. Okay, so there's a famous article, Do Trees Have Rights? And there's a guy that wrote it, and yes, they do, because again, they have a good of their own. They're striving to do something. They're trying to go up, to go towards the sun, and to maintain their own existence.
And that good being achieving the end goal, whatever that goal might be.
Right, and then that sets up on your part the duty to respect that. And at least think about it when you decide you're going to chop it down. Okay.
Nagel toys with panpsychism
too.
Yeah,
taking that a little bit further. I'm about halfway through The Secret Lives of Trees.
Good.
I've never read that, but I've heard of that. So go on.
And I don't really know what the science is behind the premises that he's putting forth in the book, but it is a larger perspective in that at least a chemical level, trees are interacting with each other and with microbes in the soil and so on. And so it gives you a much larger window for understanding what, you know, could be going on. Mm-hmm. And I, as I'm reading that, I'm struck given the nature of the conversation that we're having today and so on, that perhaps our views are going to change radically in the future as science helps us understand at a deeper and deeper level that the true interconnectedness mm-hmm. and self-support systems and collaborative support systems that have to be there for any of the world to exist. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the real science is behind that book, but I thought maybe one of the two of you knew a little bit more about that.
It's good. Amazing. I mean, basically trees are communicating, and they're communicating stress to each other.
I mean, it's very definitely
through
written
microbes
through
the soil.
From an anthropomorphic mm-hmm. perspective. Uh-huh. And layering that on to interpret what's going on, but which tied into what you were talking about a little bit earlier.
But it is like they're striving. I mean, basically, a plant can feel a stress. It sends out a chemical signal that is going out through its roots, through microbes, and to other trees, which is like nerve synapses. And it's, you know, biologically how our brain works, how our thoughts work, and then, you know, I mean, just sort of in the physical model of what's happening, it's really similar to that. So that may make us feel much more, you know, we're similar processes are working on different scales and in ways that we don't perceive, but that they can't perceive that we have thoughts maybe either. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, but the similarity of just the physical the pathway of a tree mm-hmm. communicating information is pretty amazing.
This is related to, like, I'm doing a course on artificial intelligence, but insect robots. This is what I understand. The old idea was, if you're going to have a robot do anything, you have to give the robot a picture of the world, because that's how we operate. That's consciousness, right? Here's my world, and so you got to situate everything, and then you got commands. Okay, now pick up the coffee cup and put it in the sink, okay? But we now know, and so this is what you're getting at, so I understand it, that a lot of insects, they don't have pictures of the world. They don't work on this representational way, but it's much more an engineering sort of thing. And so they've begun to create robot cockroaches and robot ants that operate, they're done by engineers. They're not programmed so much as they're created to respond to certain things that happen, just the way those things respond. Okay, and what they're pulling out of that is that they're suggesting that maybe our old picture of consciousness, that maybe there can, and you go two ways, right? You think that's not conscious, that's just interactions, as important as they are, right? And the suggestion that maybe a lot more of the things that we do are done that way too, okay? Or there's a different kind of consciousness going on, if you want to call that consciousness, okay? I mean, I think either ones have to be sort of held in mind, right? It's not old consciousness, okay? I mean, I heard you said anthropomorphizing, right? And that's sort of the bad parts of all that. Well, you just think this is just another human that can't talk to us, okay? But if you think it's just sort of an inert thing that doesn't reach out to other things and create actions, then, well, I think the science is telling us that's wrong, okay? And that's where that's where we have to go.
Actually, a question related to all of this.
And that might be panpsychism, too. That might be all some people mean about panpsychism. It's just that kind of consciousness, just not to cut you off. But go ahead, yeah.
When the signals are coming out from the trees, a stress signal and sending out to their community, is there also a response back? Is there something not just, hey, this is what's happening with me as a tree? The other trees that are in the community is got it. Either we're going to close up because something crazy is coming in, or we're going to step up and help you out. Is there a reaction that from the others that has been?
I don't know about that.
Well, actually, for what I've read in the book, let's say a certain type of insect started to chew on on the leaves, then somehow supporting messages go out, and other trees in the vicinity of a similar type get that message, if you will, and start to send over whatever they need to help the tree sustain itself. I mean, that's kind of what's, yeah, so that it's a very, it's an interactive and engaging molecular or chemical interaction.
As a virtue, I'd like to add compassion then to it, with all of that. That seems like something to strive toward and would be very valuable.
That's kind of my question is, the question of consciousness, whether it's there or not, and virtues, values, isn't, because we can say for ourselves, I hope, I think, that we have consciousness, but by simply having consciousness or to claim to have consciousness, all these questions, shouldn't there be an inherent requirement or need to claim consciousness, to also, with that, have a sense of responsibility?
I would agree. I mean, if you're a being that can not only act and react, and a lot of that might be subconscious or whatever you want to call that word, but you can also reflect, know that you're doing that, and reflect on it. I think that's the argument, that you are, whether you accept it or not, responsible now, since you can. Well, you can change it, I guess. You probably should throw in freedom as I'm thinking about it. I mean, I have the freedom as I'm thinking about that to stop or modify or change, right? So if I simply decide not to, I'm exercising that freedom, I think, in a way that probably is not as justifiable as at least judging it, okay? I mean, if I decide I shouldn't stop, everything's fine, let's just keep on. Well, that's a judgment, right?
Right, right. It can be done with or without responsibility, and that choice of... That choice. I guess it's a conscious choice, but you're talking about virtues and values and so on, and I kept on going back and saying, nope, that just doesn't fit our current leader as a nation. In my mind, it seems to be very self-interested, and it seems to be separated from responsibilities. It seems to be separated from, I think, responsibilities. I guess when I think responsible, I think of something that's not necessarily self-actuating. Like you're even talking about Benjamin Franklin. You know, it's not doing it for me. It's doing it because, and this would be the intrinsic environmentalist, I guess, doing it because it's right, because of consciousness. Even if it's to my detriment, I know that it's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's more of a open-ended thought, right? But I guess I would respond to that as you're talking about that. I pull that back to what we just said, that when you get more knowledge about how these things are working, it becomes a lot harder to sort of simply reject their status as separate over and above us. Okay, I mean, they're communicating in some sense of the word. Maybe you can put communicating in quotes with each other and reacting and keeping themselves around and changing. And
I guess what I'm saying, though, on the environment, isn't it incumbent upon us? Because we don't know about them. So whether they're communicating and taking care of themselves,
yeah,
isn't it incumbent upon us to be responsible if we claim consciousness?
I'd like to think so, okay? I guess part of me wanted to come back at that, you know, if you take a stewardship model, which I'm sympathetic to, right? But then where do you justify, my question is always, where does that stewardship, you know, how do I decide that I need to be the steward of these things? Okay, I mean, they're there, they do their thing. I do my thing, and we all do our thing together, and sometimes that works out well for all of us, and sometimes it works well just for me, and sometimes it doesn't. Why should I have a kind of a, you know, not just compassion, but a care or concern to make sure that it works out as well for you as it can? Okay, back to some of your points. I mean, because certainly you're right. People don't do that, right? They're just, it's just, I mean, I need this, we need that, you know, we have to make hard decisions, okay? In some sense of the world, the earth's going to continue no matter what we do to it, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that seems like we'd end up in the policy arena at some point. I mean, Floyd Dominy, who ran the Department of Interior, I believe, Department of Reclamation. You know, just build dams and resource conservation meant conserve every bit of something for human use. So every piece of every drop of rain that fell on the earth had to be for human consumption. And we can see, you know, because that's what, I mean, that's the framework they operated in. So it's a responsibility there means something different than the responsibility to stewardship, you know, and then the kind of the recognition. I was, as you guys were talking, I was just watching this process of the cloud, and I was thinking, well, we're all involved with these words, but we're in this process that's going around us, and we're in the midst of it, you know, out in this field. So, I don't know. Just curious about that, you know, what where that goes, because it is our words that shape that political reality or the policy reality or this even this framework.
It's our words, but it's our words and our ignorance, because you know I got the point. You know, saving every drop of water is really actually ignorant in a long range perspective. Okay, but it took a little while for us to learn that. That's where ecology and earth science comes in and other sciences. I mean, because a lot of people, you know, the anthropocentrists always say it should be enlightened anthropocentrism. But that you become enlightened as you go on in the world, right?
And with purpose, like you said. With intention and purpose.
Right. So as long as you keep that, I'm going to try to do the best I can. As I learn that that's not the best thing to do, I need to shift. It takes a long time to make those reactions.
And with that, a quote actually from, I think it was Jack Turner, comes to mind, that we only protect what we love, and we only love what we know in a deep sense. And so that understanding component is so absolutely important, I think, to the ways in which we behave in the world, or don't behave in the world.
Yeah, that's a good quote. I mean, that's exactly the message of the Pope's encyclical last year. If you read to the end, his solution is love. We have to love the earth as well as we love each other. And that means then we would want to know it more and want that knowledge to affect what we do. And be patient with ourselves too. We can't change everything right away.
Is it how we define community, sort of? I mean, I looked
at good, yeah.
Ethic.
So I'm like, oh my God, look at that. An ethic is at the communal level, yeah.
Ethic, and the idea of ethics is evolving behavior towards your community.
Mm-hmm. And who is your community?
And who's your community? And our community is people. We have, you know, this ethic, but then if we're not including the natural world in our community, or we as part of it, or it's another community, then we don't have an ethic.
It's extending our land ethic to include not just humans, but also...
Just the word land ethic. I mean, Aldo Leopold, and the whole idea of land ethic, that we actually do have an ethical responsibility to the communities that exist.
Mm-hmm. The communities that we're already in, whether we realize it or not.
And even if it's as narrow as ourselves, because what you're saying, so the values, virtues, that you they could be very self-centered. You have consciousness, but it's only of yourself. It could be family, it could be community, it could be your nation, humankind, earth, all living things, so on and so forth. It could become very spiritual, or it could be very self-centered. I completely forgot where I was going. Okay.
I do that all the time too, the older I get.
Community is partly dependence, and if we don't realize how dependent we are on a natural community, because I think we get our food from the grocery store and that kind of thing.
That's good too. I think that,
you know, and so your dependence is sort of not, people don't realize how much we depend on the natural world.
Well, Lloyd Dominy was, early in his career, was really motivated by the dependence people had on where they were situated in Wyoming, where they lived, and their dependence on water, and how important that was. And so he's just going to make sure, kind of acted through his whole career as if he's acting for that every person on the landscape that needed water.
That's where I was going with that, actually, was that consciousness is the growth of that, or breadth of that consciousness, because his was simply for... better than just for himself.
Yeah.
You know, he's not trying to build, what was his name?
Floyd Dominy.
Dominic?
Dominy.
Dominy. He's not trying to build Dominy towers everywhere. But he's trying to make sure that people have water. So it's a broader sense, but then again, for the world and for future generations, is that the right thing? So in a sense, you could even narrow it back down to yourself, because for self-continuation, survival, children, so that my children, my children's children, their children, in essence, in a way, myself, would have a means of living and living a good life.
Well, and that's what he did. I mean, there were unintended consequences, like he dammed every river in America.
He wasn't the one who did Hetch Hetchy, was he?
Times are different. We didn't understand the relationship between water
exactly.
and watersheds and stuff.
Right, and, then, and yeah, there's just simple knowledge.
Flooding.
Yeah.
And so we reached a point where that we don't build dams as much anymore.
Yeah. Was he the one that did Hetch Hetchy?
Yeah.
He did? Oh, no.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he was behind a lot of... There was a race between the Army Corps of Engineers and Department of Reclamation on making sure water resources were in use in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, so that... But we've learned from that, right? One thing I didn't mention on my little map is we're, you know, really at the headwaters of the fourth largest river in the world. All this stuff is inherent.
I was talking to someone about the concept of ecosystem services, and this has been kind of in the ecology world a little bit, but this link of, you know, if we want to try to protect landscapes and we live in our country in a capitalist system, like how do you translate that, or how do you even define the value of wilderness and healthy ecosystems as a benefit to society? And the ecosystem services is, I guess it's in four categories. One is, we're talking about just support, and that is soil and primary producers. Like, we've got to have, you know, a natural ecosystem to produce the basis for life on the planet. And then there's provisional, so food and resources. That's like what we get from it, what we more think of as the extractive part, but for all the other animals and plants too. And then regulation, so nutrient cycling, water purification, carbon sequestration, production of oxygen. So ecosystems provide services which you can actually put a monetary value on. Like, if you clean out that forest, you're gonna have to build a water treatment plant for this amount of money, because that natural wetland does that work, you know? And that's where they started saying, you know, you're going to have to trade wetlands for these things. That's how they started to define it. And the fourth one was cultural, which is how we feel, interact, study, learn, are inspired artistically, spiritually, philosophically. And that's a whole third category of an ecosystem service.
And with respect to the last one you mentioned with cultural, would that also include non-human animals within that? How we...
Okay. Yeah. So it's how, you know, it's just this kind of way of structuring it, maybe, so that when you're writing policy, you're like, well, it's actually worth something other than just... You know, people want recreation, or we want to be able to hunt, or we want these specific things that we think are only related to wilderness, or, you know, it's, again, it's kind of the conservation preservation thing, but it's like, no, it provides a lot more than what we tend to think of, what we're, it's not just
even recreation.
Tree huggers who want to hug trees, it's like oxygen, which is needed.
And yeah.
So it was interesting, and it was, and Terry Chapin and a lot of the kind of systems ecologists are like, we've got to get the science to fit the policy, and also kind of the ethic, but also the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that's the only way we can, you know, try to put it in this framework.
But wouldn't that be just as holistic as the way we want to look at the ecology now? I mean, just look at everything holistically. And it's all, you know, yeah, it's, you know, just think about an aesthetic value. Well, that's just sort of up in the air. Means no, it does, it can be, you know, at least put, maybe not necessarily translated, into economic terms and into social terms, you know, in the sense of what it's going to make us do if we don't have that.
Right. But I think it puts sort of the whole human component into one of four really important services that... ecosystems provide, whether it's a marine ecosystem or a pasture or whatever, but we're just one part of that. I mean, we're part of the provisional part, but so is everything else. Everything else needs nutrients and stuff to live. But it puts the human value part of it and interaction into one component for us. You know, the other things out there might not have that. category. I don't know. I mean, that's where the consciousness category comes in. But I think they put it out there like, this is not just for us to enjoy, but it's a central part of the functioning of the whole planet. And kind of trying to make that more obvious, I guess, to policy. I mean, that's where those meetings started. It's like, we're never going to get any of this understood if we don't find a language that puts it in perspective.
Well, even lack of enjoyment leads to more stressful lives, and that costs money, you know, in health services later on in people's lives. We found out that about pollution. Yeah, okay. This means we're all going to die 10 years earlier and of horrible diseases that are going to cost us a lot of money. So if we throw some of that money to bring the pollution down, we can mitigate that. We're going to spend it.
Yeah, and you hate to commodify something like
that. Right, you
like
do.
That.
But
but that might be the only way we can protect it, is to show its value to people who maybe value is something really different.
Yeah, it's a way to get through to different audiences.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it is important to be able to communicate that way. Otherwise, I'm talking to the same audience, and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, like the Nature Conservancy, Montana Land Reliance, they're often, sometimes funded by some very wealthy donors, you know, people that run the Federal Reserve, people that, head of banks, head of giant corporations, fly around in jets all the time. But they see that inherent value in it. I mean, they don't have to be convinced, that they're going to have an economic gain. It's nice to have the tax probably benefit, but, you know, it's kind of an interesting policy thing that we've been able to do. That's kind of cool. We'll see how long that lasts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.